The Lord be with you.
With your
a reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, but early in the morning he arrived again in the temple area, and all the people started coming to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery and made her stand in the middle. They said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they could have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and began to write on the ground with his finger. But when they continued asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let the one among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he bent down and wrote on the ground. And in response, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. So he was left alone with the woman before him. Then Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She replied, "No, sir." Then Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, do not sin anymore." The Gospel of the Lord.
Any one of us who has ever been in a difficult situation, maybe even something like being stopped by the police or the state patrol for driving too fast, we almost certainly would have some sympathy for the woman in today's gospel who was caught in adultery. Although in her case, it was actually a capital crime. It wouldn't be a matter just of a ticket. And her life was on the line. So there were very high stakes involved here, and all provoked by the scribes and the Pharisees. And Jesus replies to their tough question with an even tougher question. They, of course, as we're told, had intended to entrap him, to embarrass him, but rather in what was really an act of mercy, he ended up embarrassing them, reducing them to silence, and they eventually just slink away. And they're forced by their silence and their actions to announce, in fact, their own hypocrisy of self-righteousness. They walked away, but left standing there the one person in this whole scene who is truly righteous. Jesus does not condemn, he forgives. He forgives very simply. In fact, also he treated the scribes and the Pharisees with the very same mercy as he treated the adulterous woman. And he hints that he knows their sins, but he doesn't announce them. Rather, he treats them with precisely the same mercy as he treated the adulterous woman. And one by one, they walk away. We don't know what happened to them. Some of them may have, in fact, been impacted by Jesus' fairness and his calm. It's possible some of them followed him, and there were some genuine conversions that resulted out of this. But we don't know. What goes on with the adulterous woman? Well, Jesus offers her a brand new start. We don't know who she is. At least in tradition, it was often thought or presumed that it could have been Mary Magdalene. And that's the position that Mel Gibson took in his film, The Passion of the Christ. But she could have been anyone. And if you think about it, we are all guilty in one way or another of the kind of adultery that the prophet Hosea offers us in his book. And in Hosea's presentation of our reality, God is a spouse who has given us everything. God is a spouse who deserves our 100% loyalty. And of course, we should be worshiping the ground on which he walked. But instead, again, each one of us in our own individual, unique way has been unfaithful in the sense that we've looked elsewhere for thrills or happiness, none of which turned out to give us what was promised. And ultimately, to turn away from God and infidelity, who is the source of life itself, means our always, in these cases, choosing death. Infidelity to God, in whatever way we are unfaithful, is in fact death. Now, perhaps we're thinking it's easy to just speak some words. Neither do I condemn you. Jesus did save her from death. He gave her a new lease on life, and her assignment, her program, was simply to sin no more, to change her life, to change course. What did it cost Jesus? Well, it cost Jesus everything. He was required not just to change some aspect of life, but to lose his life. You've probably heard me mention before the famous German Lutheran theologian who was murdered in the last weeks of World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Bonhoeffer has always been known for pointing out the difference between cheap grace and costly grace. Well, grace, we know, the life of God, is free. It is absolutely unmerited. It's given to us by God in a way that transforms us and makes all things new. But that grace, although free, is also not cheap. It was paid for by the suffering of Jesus Christ, suffering that he willingly embraced out of love for you and me. And happily, that grace is available to us at every moment in great abundance. There are privileged channels of the grace, especially in the sacraments, but it's always available to us. It's offered us daily, especially in the Eucharist, in the Word of God, in prayer. This grace comes to us also in particular ways in our fasting, in our self-sacrificing on behalf of others. But ultimately, our actions speak louder than words. And our actions always give us the best indication as to whether we are, to use St. Paul's way of thinking about it, sprinting toward the prize, or rather just in some way existing in the short life that we've been given here on earth. And I think as we near the end of Lent, we can be asking ourselves, has this Lent made any difference in how we spend our time, our money, our energy? Have we used the time of this Lent in some ways, in ways we wouldn't otherwise, to share the passion, the mercy, compassion and mercy of Jesus Christ? And how we answer that question, I think, clarifies what it is that we are valuing most in this life. I want to say a few words also about our Holy Father, Pope Francis. If you were at Nativity for the Mass of Thanksgiving, you'll recall that a couple of these words I said there last Wednesday night, I believe it was. One Catholic journalist who I read wrote that a couple weeks ago he heard one of his fellow parishioners express the hope that we would get a nice pope. And as he wrote, yes, indeed, we can hope we will get a nice pope. And I think we can expect that Francis will be nice, but we can hope for even more. Remember, of course, that our Holy Father, Pope Francis, now holds an office which has really only one essential goal, and that is, you might put it in these words, to help men and women to know and to love the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who has come uniquely near us in Jesus Christ. And in the service of this one goal, we might say there are two crucial aspects of the papacy. First and foremost, the Pope must, as St. Paul wrote to Timothy, guard the deposit that has been entrusted to you. So the Pope's primary function is to preserve the apostolic tradition transmitted from age to age without deformation and without deviation. So the faith is not going to be changed. You and I, together with our bishops, we all have a role in supporting him in this project. Secondly, our Holy Father must be a man who serves as a center of unity, in the first place for all Catholics, but also for all Christians. And in that, he also will depend upon the help of many others, bishops, priests, religious, lay people especially. But that said, no pope, no matter how brilliant he might be, no matter how holy he might be, he alone is not going to be a panacea for all the challenges that you know that the church has today. So on this Sunday, you and I can rejoice that we have been given a new Holy Father. And we can say that Pope Francis is orthodox. He is tradition. He is traditional. His understanding of our faith is fully in line with the faith of Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict. And he believes in, he stands for, he speaks for the culture of life. And I just would add to that, he said things like, look, we have to be ready, if necessary, to lay down our lives to oppose the killing of these unborn children. We have to be ready, if necessary, to risk being murdered to defend unborn children. And in talking about Eucharistic coherence, he says, obviously, these politicians who stand up there and tell you how devout Catholic they are, and they're promoting, implementing the culture of death, they cannot receive communion. And I would add, I think I've alluded to this before last year, if you're in a trade union, or if you're working for an employer who tells you you're supposed to vote for someone and that person is involved in the culture of death, you cannot support them in any way. You can't. You don't take your morality from your employer or from your trade union. You take it from Jesus Christ. So we as Catholics don't want anything to do with anyone who's involved in killing unborn children or in any other aspect of the culture of death. Period. There is nothing else to be said about it. And in that reality, we know that we have the strong support of our Holy Father. We know that he loves the poor, and not merely in an abstract way. He gave away the Cardinal's Palace in Buenos Aires to a missionary order that had no money. He's been living in a small apartment, cooking his own food. He has no automobile. He rides the bus. And it's evident that he is most comfortable with people who've been living on the margins of society. He's most comfortable washing the feet of those on the margins of society. And our Holy Father himself has suffered greatly. And I think we're going to be hearing more about that in the time to come. And what about his name, Francis? Well, one of the most famous moments in St. Francis' life was the day he was passing the Church of San Damiano, this old church near the point of collapse. He went inside to pray, and kneeling before the crucifix, he was filled with great fervor and consolation. And with his tear-filled eyes gazing at the crucifix, he also heard a voice from the cross telling him three times, Francis, go and repair my house, which as you see is falling into ruin. And of course, Francis was amazed because he was alone in the church. And then St. Francis set about obeying the command, go and repair my house, which is falling into ruin. And so we can ask, could our Holy Father's intentions be any clearer to us? Pope Francis has in St. Francis a very powerful ally who loved Jesus Christ, who loved the church, who worked for reforms and led others to personal conversion and love for the church. And yes, coming back to the journalist, you and I may indeed hope that Pope Francis will be nice, but we can hope for much more. We may even hope, as Russell Shaw has written, that he may have the charm of John the 23rd, the earnestness of Paul the 6th, the charisma of John Paul the 2nd, the intellectual brilliance of Benedict the 16th. And above all, we may hope that he will have a backbone of steel. May our Holy Father always be a courageous teacher of Catholic truth in the face of all the demands of this world, that he be something far, far less.